Sunstones, Brian Buchanan, and Lindsay Hanson Park bring you this limited mini-series, The History of Mormon History. Welcome to Deseret Dramas Season 2.
Readers, in this chapter, you'll appreciate the weaponizing of the misogynistic character of BYU today. See salamanders in a new light and wonder why the phrase Ides of September was never a thing. All this and more in Chapter 5. Chapter 5. Very funny, Moroni. I know you're that salamander in the box. Mormon history gets frozen out.
If you can imagine a dark, smoldering, post-apocalyptic landscape, and then make it about Mormon history, you can get a sense of what the 80s felt like. In 1982, the same year I was born, fix it on my Wikipedia page. Let me have one more year of my 30s. The transfer of Leonard Arrington and company to BYU was completed. A decade of hope and progress hit a serious wall. Just in case the message wasn't clear enough, Boyd Packer gave a famous address to CS personnel called, "The mantle is far greater than the intellect." Seriously, this is one of the worst talks I think ever given. Remember, Packer had spent his life in academic circles, folks. High, lofty, fancy academic circles. His words were included in CS training materials and published in BYU Studies. Faithful Mormon historians were dismayed to hear the following. There is a temptation for the writer or the teacher of church history to want to tell everything, whether it is worthy or faith-promoting or not. Some things that are true are not very useful. That's the money quote right there from Packer. Some things that are true are not very useful. Think of the impacts of what that means. He goes on to say, in an effort to be objective, impartial, and scholarly, a writer or a teacher may unwittingly be given equal time to the adversary. There is much in the scriptures and in our church literature to convince us that we are at war with the adversary. We are not obliged as a church, nor are we as members obliged to accommodate the enemy in this battle. He's literally saying the good history accommodates the devil. He goes on to say, I think you can see the point I'm making. Those of you who are employed by the church have a special responsibility to build faith, not destroy it. If you do not do that, but in fact accommodate the enemy, who is the destroyer of faith, you become, in that sense, a traitor to the cause you have made covenants to protect. And let me just say something about this with Packer. This is exactly why the church starts to get into more and more moral trouble. And what I mean is we start to trade out our morals. And maybe sometimes they were always confused. But Packer, to mistake the truth as the adversary, to mistake the mistakes of men and his predecessors, and to exchange them for perfectionism, has been a cancer in the church ever since.
There's always a segment of society that loves dudes who tell it like it is, whatever that means. Packer was not shy about sharing his feelings with anyone who would listen. One venue that was listening was Newsweek. An article entitled Apostles versus Historians, such a good title, looked at the growing tensions and included comments from Mike Quinn responding to Packer's fiery diatribe. He noted that crappy safe history, quote, bordered on idolatry. Interestingly, the follow-up to this episode was a meeting with Mike Quinn and several apostles, including the Council of Grouchy Knights themselves, Mark Peterson, who organized the meeting, Ezra Taft Benson, and Boyd Packer. Quinn, surprisingly, described the meeting as congenial and supportive, two adjectives you probably would not have predicted. Well, glad they ironed things out and everybody was on the same page.
This is where Ron Howard's voice breaks in. Everyone was not on the same page. Because in 1983, a serious wave of anti-scholarship spread out with far-reaching effects. Folks like Lester Bush and Gary Bergera and even Leonard Arrington were called into their stake presidents for writing good history. Later, it came out that Mark Peterson tasked a couple friends to read things and make a list of the trouble causers. Energy well spent. Peterson would then give their stick presidents a call and assign them to deal with the perceived apostates. But of all the stories from this ridiculous period, none is so sad and unnecessary as what happened to Lyndon Newell and Val Avery, two incredible scholars and authors of Mormon Enigma, the biography of Emma Smith. Thanks to a fantastic essay that Linda recently published in Writing Mormon History, edited by friend of the podcast, Joe Geisner, we know a little bit more about this craziness. Pick up his book.
In May 1985, word went out from church headquarters, unnamed but guessable apostles, down the chain to bishops along the Mormon Belt, instructing them that Linda Newell and Val Avery could not speak in church meetings. Nothing, of course, was said to, you know, the authors themselves. Within a month, a friend clued the authors in. Because this was all transmitted verbally, the instructions were implemented differently in different places. In some locales, folks were told not to buy the book, for example. Linda, understandably, is pissed, goes to work. She calls her bishop, who informs her that, yes, he had gotten the word, but their stake president told him to keep it quiet. Nice, right? Linda got a hold of the stake president, and they met to try to figure out what the crap was going on. Was this just a speaking ban regarding the book? Could the two authors not have callings or do anything else in their wards? Who started this? Had he ever been in a Turkish prison?
If you're Mormon now or ever, and you're familiar with this culture, you can probably guess other things that happened. Rumors started flying that authors had had affairs. They had been excommunicated. They had started a cult. They weren't trustworthy. Mormon nature abhors an information vacuum. It turns out that Linda's stake president was actually a fairly decent dude, and he tried to help her. He got some information, most notably that the decision had come out of the meeting of the Quorum of the Twelve, which is fascinating and gross all at the same time. Reports that the story would be hitting the news soon spurred a meeting with Linda and two apostles, Dallin Oaks and Neil Maxwell. Linda learned an interesting tidbit, one that should seem eerily familiar by now to you. None of the apostles had, you know, actually read the book. Linda and her husband, Jack, figured that Oaks and Maxwell, who they knew, would be reasonable, given they were both authors and had worked in actual academic circles. In contrast to Packer's imaginary circles. Jack, who was getting pretty sick of this nonsense, asked pointed questions. Other, more candid books were coming out around this time, and none of these authors were getting the business from church headquarters. What was different about this book? Geez, I can't put my finger on it. Something 2X chromosomes?
Yeah, totally. I know.
Easily my favorite part of the interview came when Oaks, in his best judge voice, no doubt, sternly noted that the book, which had won the very prestigious Evans Biography Award, had been reported on in BYU Today, whatever the crap that is, and people felt like that the church was therefore endorsing the book. This is Mormon Enigma, remember. Linda had been told by both her local leaders and the apostles that they felt that she was overtly pitching her book by speaking to church groups. Okay, ready for the big scene, one that I would love to have watched. Linda, who, like Jack, is not willing to let this nonsense pass, retorts that Mormon Enigma had been a co-recipient of the Evans Award. Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism, written by Richard Bushman, remember we talked about this as the first book in the proposed 16-volume set, was the other winner of this award, and according to word on the street, had been featured in the very same issue of BYU Today. Why wasn't he getting grilled too? Boom! Mic drop, sucka. Linda's great.
So great. Oaks, who had hopefully had at least a sheepish look by now, tried to dig out of the hole. He told her, "Your book represents a non-traditional view of Joseph Smith." Guess who else wrote a book that fits that description? Brother Richard Bushman. Bushman's book, for example, was fairly candid in talking about treasure digging. Can you even imagine if Linda had written that about Joseph Smith? The kind of blowback she had gotten. This wasn't just about history. This was about whose voices were credible and who were allowed to talk about the leaders. One of the best biographies ever written about a Mormon figure, Mormon Enigma, and they think that that's a non-traditional view of Joseph Smith? What about the lived reality of the ban? When would it end? Oaks told her, quote, We all know that such oral communications expire eventually. Not helpful. And what a weird thing to say and a weird way to say it. A reporter from the LA Times asked Linda for a comment, and she read him this prepared statement. Such good words. Here's what it says, quote, "I believe in the ability of members of my church to understand and benefit from history. It may raise questions, but questions are not bad. We grow by seeking answers and understanding. When we attempt to bury aspects of our own past, we only raise another set of disturbing questions and leave people prey to emerging historical information with no context in which to put it. The answers to many of the problems the church faces today lie in our historical roots. I have asked that the decision regarding my right to speak in LDS church meetings be reconsidered by those who made it, and I am hopeful that it will." End quote.
10 silly months later, Linda was about to appear on a KSL TV program and was not excited to talk about the ban for the millionth time. So she calls her stake president and asked him to see what he could do. He did his work and reported back that another apostles' meeting had resulted in the ban being lifted magically. Rest assured that other Mormon authors were watching this episode carefully, and the chilling effect continued to spread. Now, while what happened to Linda and Val was sad and unnecessary, at least no one died in this. At the same time that the Mormon Enigma ban is going on, a truly unbelievable series of events is unfolding. Beginning in 1980, a nerdy-looking magic man named Mark Hoffman was making one incredible discovery of document after another, and they were changing how early Mormon history was thought and written about, also the value of salamanders.
One day in 1980, 25-year-old Hoffman called his wife Dory into the living room to check something out. He was looking through an old Bible, and he carefully pulled apart two pages that were stuck together and found another folded piece of paper, clearly very old. Looking inside the fold, they could see what appeared to be the signature of Joseph Smith. The next day, he takes it to Utah State University, and an archivist there helped him get the glue off and the paper completely unfolded. They discovered there were all sorts of weird symbols on it. After looking at it, they realized it seemed to be the so-called Anton transcript. Let's back up just 150 years for a moment. Remember when Joseph Smith is translating the Book of Mormon very early on and Martin Harris copies some of the characters off the plates and takes them back east to consult with scholars? He meets with Charles Anton, who inspects them. Harris later reports that this vintage Mr. Wizard gives Harris a, quote, "certificate certifying to the people of Palmyra that these were true characters and that the translation of such of them had been translated was also correct." But when Harris told him Joseph Smith was on the job, he demands the certificate back and rips it up. Anton, on the other hand, maintained that this was all nonsense and he'd known it from the beginning. Guess which version Mormons perpetuated? Well, Hoffman had found the paper Harris had taken to Anton. The Bible it was in apparently came down in the Smith family. Ironclad case.
Hoffman, getting excited at this point, takes it over to the Institute at Utah State and shows it to one of the teachers, Dan Bachman, who incidentally wrote a very influential dissertation on Joseph Smith and polygamy. So this Institute teacher immediately recognizes how wildly important this is and makes some calls to Salt Lake. The next day, they drive down so Hoffman can show it to the folks at the Historical Department. Arrington and Homer Durham check it out and are amazed. They get Gordon Hinckley and Packer over to their office, and then they get the first presidency on the horn. And at this juncture, a fairly well-known photograph is taken where Hoffman is showing the document to the first presidency. Spencer Kimball has a magnifying glass in his hand, and they're all poring over it. Packer's looming in the background. Honestly, I imagine this photo didn't take a lot of staging. Imagine, this would have been really cool to see.
Hoffman continues to find all sorts of wild stuff. Money digging agreements, a letter from Lucy Mack Smith with stuff from the lost 116 pages, a David Whitmer letter affirming his testimony of the Book of Mormon, etc. But the next major find was pretty earth-shaking. In 1981, Hoffman tried to sell the LDS Church a document, apparently written by Thomas Bullock, a scribe with a fairly distinctive handwriting, that was supposedly a blessing given by Joseph Smith to his son, Joseph Smith III, in 1844. One sentence, quote, "He shall be my successor to the presidency of the high priesthood a seer and a revelator and a prophet unto the church, which appointment belongeth to him by blessing and also by right, quote, was enough to get anyone's attention. We're talking succession crisis answers, people. Also fun was an associated letter written by Bullock to Brigham Young in 1865, accusing him of trying to destroy any copy of the blessing he could find. So it's like a document backing up his document. The RLDS Church, as you may remember, was formally organized in 1860 with Joseph Smith III as prophet and president. Scholars had long pieced together some hints that such a blessing may have happened, and now, all of a sudden, here was the document. This was really something.
Hoffman's contact at the LDS Archives was apparently kind of ho-hum about buying it, so Hoffman moves on to the RLDS Church, who, not surprisingly, jumped. Hoffman, though, pulled it back from them without telling them and traded it to the LDS Church, getting about $20,000 worth of stuff. So when the RLDS folks find out about the switcheroo, they were muy pissed. So, to smooth things over, the LDS Church ends up trading this blessing to the RLDS cousins for a copy of the Book of Commandments. The RLDS Church produced an awesome promotional booklet about it, a copy of which hangs on my wall, and they even included the blessing in the appendix of their Doctrine and Covenants the following year.
The next big find was one that was so exotic that it is the document most commonly associated with Hoffman, the Salamander Letter. The letter, written by Martin Harris to W.W. Phelps, recounted events of early Mormonism, but with a twist. The familiar events were recast in the context of overt folk magic. Moroni, yeah, he morphed into a white salamander at the Hill Cumorah. This time, rather than the LDS Church buying it, Steve Christensen, a young businessman with a passion for Mormon history, bought it through an intermediary from Hoffman for $40,000. Yeah, 4 and 4 zeros. Christensen tried to fund a research team involving BYU professor Ron Walker and friend of the program Brent Metcalf. Unfortunately, his personal finances imploded and the project had to be canned. Mike Quinn, who was constantly getting questions about this folk magic business, didn't want to wait for these guys to finish their project so that the folk magic could be presented in context, so he dove into it himself, resulting in his book, Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, which was published after the bombings and forgeries were discovered. Whoops, did I say that part out loud? Disregard.
Next up, not just one document, but an entire collection, the fabled McClellan Collection. This one never actually materialized, however. Hoffman was telling multiple people about it, hyping it to try and get investors. We're talking several orange crates full of awesome stuff coming from Apostle William McClellan, who eventually grew disenchanted and left Mormonism. We're talking diaries, letters, papyrus from the Book of Abraham, stuff about polygamy and Emma and Nauvoo, stuff to make historians do the Looney Tunes-style bulgy eyes and such. What he does, Hoffman ends up playing a game of robbing Nephi to pay Pahoran. So he takes money from dudes on this side and uses it to pay off other investors. At the same time, Hoffman was banking on selling his biggest find of all, one outside of Mormonism altogether, the Oath of a Freeman, thought to be the first printed document in America. Big stuff. No copy of this had ever been discovered. At one point, the Library of Congress was this close to picking it up for a cool $1.5 million. Now, had this gone through, it would have solved all of his Nephi Pahoran problems and might have seriously changed some things. But the Library of Congress was dragging their feet and Hoffman was getting desperate. Thanks to his connections at the church office building, Hoffman was issued a $185,000 unsecured loan. How does the song go? I've got friends in general authority places where the cosigners drown and the Benjamins chase my debts away. Something like that.
So the big kid loan was coming due and Mr. Mark W. Hoffman did not have the dollars. His house of non-face cards was coming down quick. And this is where the story moves from fascinating to truly horrifying. On October 15th, 1985, Salt Lake was rocked by a pipe bomb explosion at the downtown Judge Building. Steve Christensen, who had bought the Salamander Letter, lay dead in the doorway of his office. 3 hours later, while police were still trying to figure out what the crap was going on, another bomb exploded in Holiday, killing Kathy Sheets. When people connected the dots, Sheets' husband Gary had been business partners with Steve Christensen earlier, the story became freaky. What was going on?
The next morning, people in Salt Lake very much still on edge, the scene repeats. This time, the victim manages to survive, being dragged out of his burning car in front of the Deseret Gym, where the conference center is now. Police finally figured out who this injured man was. His name? Mark Hoffman. Salt Lake became basically an active crime scene. Multiple people had their cars and homes searched. No one could figure out what was going on. Who was next? Police investigated and started to grow suspicious that bomb victim number three, Mr. Hoffman, was a little shady. But they couldn't crack the case until a forensic investigator, George Throckmorton, made a sensational discovery. Under UV light, documents like the salamander letter and the Anton transcript displayed this unique cracking pattern in the ink. All this amazing stuff that Mark Hoffman had discovered? Not discovered. Forged. Yep, down in his basement, Hoffman, who had been a somewhat closet doubter since his early teens, set about to change and disrupt Mormon history. And the list just kept growing. In addition to all these wild Mormon documents, he'd been adding signatures to first editions of valuable books, making them more valuable, like he took a copy of Call of the Wild and added a Jack London signature to make it much more valuable, Betsy Ross documents, even an Emily Dickinson poem. So along the way, he fooled basically everyone. Folks at the LDS Historical Department, book and document dealers, the FBI, document experts, you name it. Even the one person who had raised his eyebrow at the salamander letter, Gerald Tanner of the Tanner's fame, didn't really think that Hoffman himself had forged it.
Obviously, the biggest impact of the Hoffman case was the gaping hole left in two families. Young father and husband Steve Christensen and beloved mother and grandmother Kathy Sheets were gone. Mormon history would also have to take stock. Though the documents had been forged, the context they had brought to the surface was legitimate. The influence of treasure digging and folk magic had to be incorporated into the narrative of early Mormonism. Trust in experts was also shaken. Since Hoffman had fooled essentially everyone, people had to reassess the confidence they had had in documents and established narratives. His exotic discoveries had made their way into several books published during this period. The shadow of Mark Hoffman was just another element in an environment that was increasingly hostile to historians.
Mormon leaders certainly weren't about to let up. Increasingly, candid history was painted as speaking evil of the brethren. Dallin Oaks warned the LDS faithful that, quote, "It does not matter that the criticism is true." A truly incredible statement. Words started to shift into actions. David Wright was let go from BYU in 1987 for his views, even though he had tried hard to keep them out of his teaching. A statement in 1991 condemned recent symposia, which everyone in the know recognized as code for dun-dun-dun, Sunstone. Had this very podcast been released in the early 90s, it might well have come into the crosshairs of general authorities. Then, in 1992, an Orwellian undercurrent came to light when Jean England made a dramatic announcement that a secretive organization called the Strengthening Church Members Committee maintained files on suspected subversive Mormons. Where did he make that announcement? In the Q&A on a Sunstone panel. Then the next year, Boyd Packer boiled down his concerns into three categories: the gay-lesbian movement, the feminist movement, and so-called scholars or intellectuals. These groups, dangers to the LDS Church. But the most memorable episode came in 1993.
Enter Gordon Hinckley, a man of many contrasts. He had put up a lot of his own personal money to buy a Mark Hoffman document earlier, and had been mostly successful a decade earlier in ordering Mark Peterson to stand down from his self-appointed mission to discipline alleged dissidents. Boyd Packer was more than ready to pick up the torch after Peterson's death. His MO was much the same as Peterson's. Working essentially on his own, he passed word down the priesthood chain of authority so that it appeared local leaders were taking the initiative. In September, six people were disciplined within a couple weeks of each other. They ranged across the spectrum from Lynn Knavel Whitesides and Maxine Hanks, who argued for a more progressive role for women in the LDS Church and used historical documents to back that up, to popular conservative author Avraham Gileadi, who had written of a latter-day's leader yet to appear. Levina Fielding Anderson, who was once an editor of the Ensign, had relentlessly shone light on patterns of spiritual and ecclesiastical abuse and documented those. Michael Quinn had consistently published exhaustively documented studies of Mormon history that demonstrated the ever-human quality of church leaders. This was not a good fit for Mormon orthodoxy. And the final member of the ad hoc group, Paul Toscano, had just taken a bullet for his wife, Margaret, who was the original target of their stake president for writing about Heavenly Mother. If you're feeling concerned about that, don't worry. Margaret got her own excommunication in 2000. Not surprisingly, the media was all over that story. And if you can think back to the widespread attention given to the dual excommunication of Kate Kelly and John DeLynn, remember this was six people rather than just two people at the same time, the September 6th.
The gradual opening of the archives of the historical department that had begun in the 60s and reached its apex during the Leonard Arrington years had swung back the other way. By 1986, researchers were required to sign a form indicating that they needed to submit material they intended to publish to a review committee. The days of historians reading Heber J. Grant's diaries and first presidency minutes side by side were now a thing of the past. However, a project initiated by Leonard's crew in exile, the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute, would plant the seeds of a resurgence of Mormon history. Next time in the sixth and final chapter.
This series was written by Brian Buchanan, co-hosted by Lindsay Hansen Park, co-produced by Sunstone and Laurel Smith Steele. If you like what you hear, please consider a donation at sunstone.org.